It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. The big news of the day, guilty on all three counts. Murder in the second degree, murder in the third degree, manslaughter in the second degree. Maximum sentence for the most serious crime, 40 years in prison, 25 for third degree murder, and up to 10 years for second degree manslaughter. Chances are he's going to spend, Derek Chauvin going to spend a good portion of the rest of his life behind bars for what was really out in front and apparent. And the thing is that this is not really justice. This is simply accountability. And the positive thing is that it shows accountability is possible. Rare, extremely rare, but possible. And if you ask anyone who saw the video of a man being face down on the pavement with Derek Chauvin's knee in his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, everyone that you ask says it's excessive. I have yet to find someone who will look me in the eye and go, no, that's perfectly fine. There have been some provocateurs, some folks who want to stir things up a little bit, go, no, that's proper, even though the police didn't, the police chief himself said, this isn't how we train people. Going to be interesting to see what the sentencing is, but for today, accountability. Not justice, accountability. Justice is something that I don't know that you're going to get because we haven't figured out how to bring people back from the dead yet. And at the end of the day, I've gotten a bunch of people sending me emails going, I'm happy. This is, a lot of people are vindicated. I'm going, no, someone's still dead. A family is without their loved one. And on the other side, the police officer's family is going to be without a loved one. And it's because of the system that he was a part of. And I still say training had a lot to do with it. I still think culture has a lot to do with it. And we have a lot of work that has to be done. And forthright, a lot of work on a lot of fronts. Police relations, inequality, both social and economic. The good thing, though, the country breathes a sigh of relief. The fear had been in here in Pennsylvania, where I'm at, and in Wisconsin and in Minnesota and in states across this country, that there was a possibility after watching that video that there was still potentially a possibility, because we've seen this happen before, where the police officer is found not guilty for what is an egregious crime. And one right before your very eyes. I'm not going to tell you that being a cop isn't a tough job. It is. And we give them a lot of power. We give them a lot of authority. And we give them a lot of protection. But it's not unlimited on any of those levels. And there has to be, with all of that power and authority, there has to be some accountability. And the thing is what's interesting to me is, days after Floyd's death, Chauvin was ready to plead guilty. He was ready to accept a plea deal that would have put him in jail for about 10 years. He was going to plead guilty to third-degree murder. But the Trump administration wasn't going to let it happen. Billy Barr would not sign off on it because he thought, well, we might have riots. Which is interesting when you hear the right-wing spin machine, go on about how this is, this is ridiculous. And how this is just a bunch of leftists. But for now, accountability. And somewhere to grow from. A stepping stone towards somewhere hopefully better. Because lives are ruined. There's no going back from that. And I'm not going to, there's no celebrating You know, like I said, I've got emails from people who are, you know, like, oh, there are a lot of people who are going to be happy with this. No, there's no happiness. This is terrible all the way around. A man is dead and another family is, and their family is forever with a hole in it. And same with Derek Chauvin's family. Now, was he wrong? Absolutely. In my view, watching that video, there is literally no excuse. Well, the defense tried, and they made a valiant effort. No excuse. Some leaders today came out and said, look, you know, Joe Biden came out and said, I pray that the decision goes on the right side. And I think that was the view of the entire country. Of course, he was attacked for it. He went on and say that about the verdict, that no one is above the, should be above the law. Today's verdict extends that message, but it is not enough. Joe Biden said, we can't stop here. Barack Obama weighed in saying, while today's verdict may have been a necessary step on the road to progress, it was far from a sufficient one. We cannot rest. And as we continue the fight, we can draw strength from the millions of people, especially young people, who have marched and protested and spoken up over the last year, shining a light on inequality and calling for change. Barack Obama says justice is closer today, not simply because of this verdict, but because of their work. Tim Scott, Republican senator from South Carolina. There's no question in my mind the jury reached the right verdict. You go down and Oprah Winfrey, relieved as she was, cried tears of joy as each of the three verdicts were read. John Gordon, executive director of the ACLU of Minnesota, said today for the first time in state history, a white police officer has been held accountable for killing a black man. The head of the NBA, the commissioner Adam Silver, said, we're pleased that justice appears to have been served, but we also recognize there is much to be done. Boris Johnson, prime minister of Britain, I was appalled by the death of George Floyd, he says, and welcome this verdict. My thoughts tonight are with George Floyd's family and friends. And Mariah Carey, she too chimed in on Twitter saying, a beginning, a small grain of hope for the future. And that's where I'm at. This is not, in my view, vindication. This is not justice. This is simply a mild measure of accountability that I think in my world is what is the norm. And this is one of those moments where, you know, having conversations with my black friends who did not expect a conviction, where I look at that and I go, how else can you come to anything but? They're so used to not having that kind of assurance in our justice system that this is maybe a surprise and maybe something on a certain level to be a little bit joyous about. I find no joy in it, and I don't know how you can. But if you're expecting nothing and this kernel happens, maybe. You know, maybe that's it. And this is where I think having these conversations are really important. And identifying that we do live in different worlds. And as I said earlier in the week, I've been fairly fortunate in my life. You know, I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood. High poverty area. I now live in a very middle class, solidly middle class white neighborhood. I've seen both cultures. And I understand when people in my world now look at the police, they see their neighbor, they see a friend, they see somebody that they see at the grocery store. They see somebody that their kids go to school with and play sports with and do all those things. They see somebody like them. Where I grew up as a kid, there were no cops living in our neighborhood. They got out. They got their families out. This is why I've always believed that if you're going to be police an area, you've got to be part of that community. It's not one of these things that you can come in from the outside, go live in the suburbs or go live somewhere else and then come in and interject yourself in. You've got to be part of that community. The families in that neighborhood have to know you, have to be part of your family and identify with who you are. And look, we need to do a much better job of raising the standards of living for all working people in this country. And to me, it all comes back down to that socioeconomic part. Because, look, everybody wants to do a little bit better for themselves, and the police are no different. But to have a residency requirement, I think, is something that isn't absolute. And you have to live in the district that you work in. And I know people say, well, but you're going to put police in an unsafe situation. They live in my neighborhood. I know who they are. We interact together. I think it can be done. Now, what's been interesting to me is I've been watching the right-wing spin machine lose its mind. And guilt doesn't seem to be something that they quite understand. OAN, one of the mouthpieces over there, said that, well, the jurors, you know, they may have feared for their lives, which is why they found him guilty. All of this amounts to what would be considered jury tampering, they said. A guy on Fox News, Greg Gutfeld, he said, I'm glad that he was found guilty on all charges, even if he might not be guilty of all charges. You know, I'm glad he was found guilty, but, you know, he might not be. You watch that video, he was guilty as hell. There's no question about it. Newsmax, a guy named Rob Schmidt, he said that the jury decided to sacrifice Chauvin to the mob. Yeah, sacrifice. I guess you didn't watch the video like the rest of us. And my favorite came from former Trump lawyer Jenna Ellis. Jenna, you know, over on Fox News, you know, read someone else's script. I don't think she's bright enough to read that focus group tested racist message the way she did. But, you know, look, they're reinventing spin over there on Fox News. She kept hammering on the word social justice as if it's something bad. Corporate guilt. Chauvin is white. Floyd is black. That means the left believes he's guilty automatically. Retribution for white guilt. The jury was influenced by social justice warriors. It's not that they watched the video. It's not that they watched a man lying face down on the ground for 9.5 minutes while someone else had his knee in his neck and you watched the life go out of him. I mean, I watched that video a couple of times and I don't know about you, but it was one of those things where you watched the life go right out of him. You could see the minute he left. And it's not like he left voluntarily. And I know he has a big heart. He had a big heart. My other favorite, Jenna Ellis, and Ellis comment. Chauvin was made to pay for the sins of white people collectively. He was sacrificed. That kind of frame. And what's interesting is you look at the right wing and their messaging are all coordinated really well. Give them credit. Give them credit. They do a nice job of coordinating their message. It's not about guilt or innocence with them. It's not, did he actually do it? No, it has nothing to do with that. It's all about the spin. The spin is he was sacrificed. He was found guilty because of white guilt. I didn't find him guilty. I wouldn't have found him guilty from white guilt. I would have found him guilty because he did it. What happened to us when you look at something and you go, that is wrong? Is that too difficult to understand? Is that too hard to get to? Sadly, and I talked about this yesterday a little bit, and this is where I think we have to do differently by our police departments. We have to seek out the best talented people possible. We have focused our attention on a specific type of person to be a police officer. Not really problem solvers. And I point to Connecticut. Back in 2000, there was a federal court case in the 2nd U.S. District Court of Appeals of New York that upheld a lower court decision that said that this guy who tested above the average, because Connecticut only wanted to have someone with an IQ of, well, you know, somewhere around just a bit, a touch above average, because they'd get bored with the job. They wouldn't follow orders as well. They wouldn't be as black and white. They would be more apt to go, well, you know, there's some gray here. This guy had an above average IQ, was not allowed to be a police officer because they didn't interview him. They said, nope, sorry, you scored better than everyone on the test. Yes, we know you're way up there, but sorry, your IQ tests you out. For me, that's the guy I think I want. I want someone who's going to come into a situation without thinking, hey, I have a hammer, everything is a nail. I'd like him to come into a situation and go, well, I've got a whole toolbox full of things to use. What shall I use? What shall we do here? Instead of smashing things, because look, I'm still stuck on the point that I remember, and I guess it's because I'm a little bit older, I remember a time when the police, they would put you up against the car, your hands on the car, one hand behind your back, one hand behind your back, and they handcuffed you. And then they would tap the top of your head and help push you into the car so that you didn't hit your head. Sometimes, if you were getting a little mouthy, they'd bang your head against the thing. That happened. I'm not saying it didn't. But now, it's this whole difference of the training is no longer put your hands up against the car. It's always face down on the ground. It's always your face in the ground, knee in the back somewhere, hands on legs, completely immobilized. Because they view every person that they interact with as somebody of danger. And look, could this be the fact that we have so many damn guns floating around? Maybe. Because look, I got to tell you, if I'm a cop, I don't want to pull somebody over at 1 o'clock in the morning on a dark road in the middle of nowhere. I'm with them. They need to be safe. But we also have to do something on the other side where everything turns into a physical confrontation and everything turns into people being slammed to the ground. But this is not, this, in my view, not justice, this accountability. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is a step, at least I think a step in the right direction. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit about what's going on in West Virginia. Joe Manchin coming around on the PRO Act. Maybe something on Green New Deal. Right back after this. Nothing more American than workers standing up.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 workers and injuring 17 more. The rig experienced an initial blowout, releasing an uncontrollable flow of oil and gas from the well. Hydrocarbons then ignited, causing the explosion and fire. It caused a massive offshore oil spill of over 4 billion barrels and is considered the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history. British Petroleum was the main operator responsible for the well's design. The drilling contractor, Transocean, owned and operated the rig. A handful of smaller companies were also involved. While company and governmental officials initially argued the explosion was unforeseeable and then subsequently blamed each other, there were warning signs in the months leading up to the deadly explosion. Multiple equipment failures, design deficiencies, poor preventative maintenance, bad engineering decisions, and a chase for profits that emphasized low worker injuries at the expense of process safety all combined to create the disaster. As well, regulations and standards enforcement were weak in an almost totally deregulated industry. One phrase used by investigators to characterize the explosion was the normalization of deviance. From workers to managers to executives, none saw the explosion coming. There were dozens of contributing factors, as the Chemical Safety Board investigation noted. They listed 57 key technical, human, and regulatory factors in their 2016 final report. However, engineers had raised concerns about the potential failure of key equipment. Workers were sensitive to the fact that they could be fired for raising safety concerns that delayed drilling. BP was ultimately found responsible and racked up over $70 billion in fines, cleanup, and settlement costs. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like Joe Biden has pledged to cut greenhouse gases in half by 2030. That is a huge commitment. And the idea, bring the rest of the world on board to our commitment to dealing with climate change. And look, there's been some big news this week already. You had Cecil Roberts out of the Mine Workers Union yesterday come out and say that they're going to work with Biden to try and move some of those, get some of those coal miners, those green jobs, get some training money. That will help the state of West Virginia, which I think is a good thing. I wish it was 6 years ago so we wouldn't have had to deal with the Trump years, but better late than never. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, what we do with our climate, and also the good news, Joe Manchin coming around on the PRO Act. I've asked Josh Hoard to come talk with us. Josh is the president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here, Rick.
So, big news on the Manchin front. Signed on to the PRO Act. I said originally, I can't imagine how he couldn't sign on to it, being from West Virginia, and with the labor history that you guys have got there, I couldn't imagine how he couldn't sign on to that.
Not really surprised. You know, Joe Manchin has a 90% voting record over his life in Congress there. And, so, you know, look, we started discussions with him last summer, well in advance of the 2020 general election, started having discussions with him and his team. And then we, you know, sort of took a break for election activities. Then after the Georgia special election, we re-engaged with Senator Manchin and his team and had a number of good conversations informally last Friday. I had a Zoom meeting with Senator Manchin, with myself and my entire executive board, and we formally asked him to co-sponsor the PRO Act. And, you know, I thought that it may take a little longer for him to get back to us. It happened pretty quickly. He reached out Monday morning, and he and President Roberts from the UMWA were going to have an event sometime on Monday with the press club, I believe, and he made his announcement then. Obviously, we're very pleased. We're tickled to death. We appreciate his support on this. And look, we recognize that, you know, this is just the first step. I try to stay as far away from DC politics as I possibly can, quite honestly, because we have so much to focus on here in West Virginia and the attacks that we've seen from our governor and state legislature over the last few years has been detrimental to the labor movement here. So we try to stay focused on things here in West Virginia, but you know, very pleased and thankful for Senator Manchin to step up to the plate and co-sponsor the PRO Act.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, you bring up your governor and the attacks that have happened there. For me, the PRO Act is to undo some of the damage that the Republicans in your state have done. And Jim Justice himself, your governor, has come out and said, look, you know, we did right to work because they said all these jobs were coming. It didn't come. We did away with, you know, some prevailing wage because we were told that was going to help. It didn't work. None of these gimmicks work. Can we just admit that now and move forward with getting something to give people the right to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and move our economy forward?
I'm kind of hoping that he gets called to Congress to testify because he said what we all know to be true, that right to work is a gimmick. It's used to as a feel-good sort of message to try to make your state look a little more favorable for big corporations. It does not work. They tied that with the elimination of prevailing wage a few years ago. And what we've seen as a result of that is exactly what we said would happen. You see lower wages, fewer benefits, and workplaces that are less safe. You know, we applaud Senator Manchin for signing on. Hopefully, you know, this thing gets some traction and there's a pathway moving forward so we can undo the damage that has been done in West Virginia and I think 26 other states as it relates to right to work. But yeah, Jim Justice, he made it really clear, right to work and prevailing wage did not work. It absolutely did not work. He said so on numerous occasions. Maybe they'll call him up to Congress to testify.
Or maybe we can get him here to Pennsylvania, because I fear 2022, the governor's race here, it's going to all be around making Pennsylvania a no-rights-at-work state. And look, when you've got a Republican governor like Justice saying, it doesn't work, hey, Pennsylvania, you should probably listen. Because, again, it's just another bad idea. But, you know, going back to Manchin and the PRO Act, I'll be honest, I was critical from the start. It's a nice gesture. Without any type of filibuster reform, I don't know that it gets passed. Have you had any conversations with the senator on, yeah, he's gonna sponsor it, but how is he gonna work to get it moved through so that we actually get some movement on it?
Well, that's a good question, and I think, you know, that comes in the very near future. We wanted to start out by simply identifying the reasons why we believe it's very important for working families that the PRO Act be seriously considered. You know, we didn't talk about the filibuster. It was very, that was off the table in terms of our discussions thus far. We wanted him to be a co-sponsor. He agreed. You know, look, I don't know. I don't know where this conversation goes from here, but we will be having follow-ups with Senator Manchin. I mean, give the guy credit. And look, I get how he can frustrate some, but the reality is, if it's not him, we're talking about going back to Senator Manchin's most recent election in 2018. He beat a horrible attorney general here in West Virginia that would have been another puppet for Mitch McConnell to use however Mitch wants to in the United States Senate. So look, we're in the game here, and trust me, we do not want a guy like Attorney General Patrick Morrissey up there, because it's bad for workers. And I appreciate Senator Manchin stepping up when we asked him to.
No, I'm with you. Look, as harsh as I am to Joe Manchin, I'm grateful that he is where he is, because this would be a Republican Senate right now without him. So we wouldn't even be having this conversation. But I do like to push a little bit in the direction of West Virginia is a union state, in my view. It's got a rich, bloody history of workers fighting for better wages, hours, conditions. The coal wars are something that should be taught in every school. And my thought is that with his background in that, this should be something that he should be active in pushing for.
Yeah. And look, Rick, that's what's so frustrating for us here on the ground, because, you know, we have Senator Manchin and a Republican, Shelley Moore Capito, plus three Republican members in the House of Representatives. And you know, Shelley Moore Capito is likely not in the game here. All three of our Republican members in the House of Representatives voted no. And it's unfortunate, because I've seen the polling. Unions in general are favorable regardless of what party we're talking to. So, you know, and I think that's the problem with some of the things that come with Washington, is how polarizing and partisan it has become over the years. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it's just the lay of the land. But, you know, there's no excuse for some of our Republican representatives in Congress not to seriously consider a piece of legislation that will have a very positive impact on working families throughout West Virginia. It's really sad, Rick.
Especially given the fact that we just witnessed publicly one of the more egregious anti-union campaigns put on by Amazon. They spent $200 million to turn back that campaign. And now we find out the RWDSU is, you know, filing charges for things that we know that they do. The intimidation, the threatening of layoffs, the threatening of closures, you know, all of the loss of benefits, all of the things that they threaten if the PRO Act were to pass, they wouldn't be able to do. They wouldn't be able to hold these captive audience meetings where they can threaten and intimidate. They wouldn't be able to plaster the bathroom stall, literally the bathroom stalls, with anti-union propaganda and have, you know, felons walking around with sandwich boards on the shop floor. It would be as it was when my grandparents' generation were creating the most prosperous working class in history. And that's where I want to go back to.
Well, look, Rick, I think that's a great example to discuss as we talk about the PRO Act, because there are a number of things in the PRO Act that would address some of the tactics, some of the illegal and wrong tactics that were used in that organizing campaign. You know, I don't know, you know, what the future holds, you know, as it relates to Amazon workers. But what I know about, organizing in West Virginia is That all we want is a level playing field. We're tired of the odds stacked against us. And, you know, the PRO Act addresses that. It gives us a fair shot. And we know the best way to a middle-class job is through the labor movement, through a union, through having that voice in the workplace. I listened to your intro here, and you were exactly right. An individual is not going to be successful in doing so. It's been tried over and over and over again, and it's failed almost unanimously. You've got to have that collective voice. This is a real opportunity to give workers a chance to have a seat at the table. And that's all we're asking for. Well, look, we're not asking for the moon here. We're just asking for a level playing field. The PRO Act delivers on that. Hopefully, you know, we can figure out a way to get it through and help working families. Rising tide lifts all ships.
Yeah.
And, you know, the labor movement built the middle class, and we've got, you know, we've got our work cut out for us, given the odds that are stacked against us right now.
As I always say, I don't want to make a killing. I just want to make a living. That's all. It seems pretty simple to me. I do want to change gears real quick because Cecil Roberts yesterday did come out and say that he's going to work with the Biden administration on some green energy jobs. This has got to be fairly controversial in your state, a coal state that, you know, Trump won because he was going to bring coal back. He was going to make coal great again. That didn't happen because, you know, everything else is going on. How are his comments playing, do you think, now?
Well, look, you know, he just delivered the remarks recently, so we'll see. But, you know, Cecil Roberts is a respected individual across the spectrum here in West Virginia. And I know the union, you know, the UMWA, the great UMWA, has done a lot of soul searching. So this is not something that's off the cuff. This is something that they you know, Cecil and his team have considered for some time. You know, look, President Trump went all over Appalachia and elsewhere and promised to deliver and bring coal jobs back to the community. Last time I checked, I believe there were more coal company bankruptcies filed while Donald Trump was president as opposed to the 8 years that President Obama was president. And we lost even more coal jobs as a result of that. So, you know, people bought into Senator Trump's rhetoric that he was going to bring coal jobs back. It didn't happen. You know, for whatever reason, it didn't happen. I mean, I think we can talk a long time about why that didn't happen, but it didn't. So, you know, Appalachia has to take a hard look at, you know, what opportunities we have moving forward, because whether or not you like it, it's the hand that's been dealt. So I appreciate President Roberts and folks at the UMWA for taking, you know, a positive initiative here. Look, this is still gonna not set well. There's still people throughout West Virginia and other coal communities in the United States of America that believe that coal is going to come back in some capacity to the way it was when it was booming. And I'm not sure that's a realistic approach. So, you know, I applaud President Roberts for making a bold statement, and, you know, we'll see where it plays out. But, you know, he's a well-respected individual throughout West Virginia. So his words have meaning. And I think it gives us a real opportunity to be in the game, to be at the table. And I think that's first and foremost where he's coming from. We've got to be at the table. And I couldn't agree with him more on that. It's critically important for coal communities to be a part of any major infrastructure and energy discussion.
This is, in my view, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, this is an excellent opportunity for West Virginia, because you've got someone like Cecil Roberts who's, you know, bringing the labor movement into this, into the green energy idea that, hey, we're going to create these good union jobs and they've got to be union jobs. And you've got Manchin, who really has Biden by the short hairs. There's an opportunity for West Virginia to do really well in this and to get some major investment, you know, as a way to, you know, kind of pay back the loss of those jobs. We've never really done industrial justice well. When communities lost factories, when we deindustrialized, you know, towns across this country, we did nothing to help them. This is an opportunity to say to West Virginia, yeah, you're going to lose the coal industry, but we're going to give you something to replace it, and you're going to be okay.
Well, look, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the concern that I have is if we don't take advantage of this opportunity that's in front of us now, I'm not sure if we'll get another chance or another bite at the apple, as they say. This is our chance to help coal communities, you know, all over the United States and under and other industries that have suffered. Look, we've got a chance to revitalize. Now, it's going to require some change. It's going to require some innovation. But I applaud President Biden and Senator Manchin and folks like Cecil Roberts who are ready to sit down and have real conversations. It's not going to be easy. Look, we understand that. I mean, we continue to struggle in all kinds of different arenas here in West Virginia as a result in part of the decline of the coal industry. But we have a chance to do something positive with that now. We can't miss this opportunity. And I think it's great that labor leaders are working with folks like Joe Manchin and President Biden to try to do right for working families, not just in West Virginia, but all over the United States.
Which brings me back to the PRO Act again. Virtually my entire working life, Josh, you know, 30 plus years, we've had Democratic politicians talk about, hey, we're going to reform labor law. We're going to bring you strike replacement. We're going to, you know, undo some of the harshness of Taft-Hartley. We're going to bring card check. None of that seems to happen. This is a moment where there's a guy sitting in the White House who's come out and made a pretty definitive statement. So for me, this is that moment that this has to happen.
I couldn't agree more. This is that moment. And, you know, we've just got to figure out how to get there. You know, D.C. is tough right now. And I get the concerns about a lot of different things on pathway and whatever. But this is critically important for working families. We've got to make sure it happens. It's the best way to build a middle class. And when you have a healthy middle class, then you have real opportunities to grow the economy. I mean, you have prosperity. You're not going to do that without a healthy middle class. This is the best way to do that, but to make sure that we have good wages, fair benefits, and a safe workplace. And that's what we're fighting for here in West Virginia.
Absolutely. Something we most certainly need to do. And I suggest you contact your senators early, contact them often, say we need to have the PRO Act passed. Josh, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Big fan, Rick. Thanks, buddy. Keep up the good work.
Appreciate it, Josh Swart. He's the president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO. Make sure you check out their website, WVAFLCIO.org. We'll get links out so you don't have to spell it yourself. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1853. That was the day that Harriet Tubman led her first trip on the Underground Railroad, the clandestine network that helped enslaved people escape slavery and move north to freedom. One of the most remembered conductors on the railroad, Tubman herself escaped slavery in eastern Maryland. Tubman had been forced to work in the fields, performing back-breaking labor under a brutal overseer. As a girl, Tubman was injured when she was hit in the head by a weight thrown by an overseer. The injury plagued her with headaches and visions that Tubman attributed as signs from God. To escape these harsh conditions, Tubman had to leave her family behind. But she did not forget them. On her first trip to free those enslaved, the group included her sister and two children. On subsequent trips, she helped lead her brother and aged parents to freedom. In all, Tubman made 19 trips back to the South. She became known as Moses, leading her people out of bondage. These journeys came at a personal risk for Tubman. Enraged Southerners placed a $40,000 bounty on her head. But Tubman was known to say that she never lost a single passenger. The Civil War did not stop Tubman's bravery. She worked as a cook, a nurse, and even a spy for the Union Army. The renowned abolitionist Frederick Douglass wrote a letter for Tubman where he wrote, quote, "The midnight sky and the silent stars have been the witnesses of your devotion to freedom and of your heroism. The horrors of the slave labor system ended in the United States because of the courage of those like Harriet Tubman who risked their lives to stand up against injustice." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So during the break, got an email from Brian who says that today's verdict is just a stepping stone towards equality and justice. And I agree. And I said at the beginning, just a stepping stone to get us where we want to go, to a much better place, a little more egalitarian, a little more equal. Because after all, when all of us are doing better, all of us are doing better. Here to share some thoughts on, well, maybe we'll get some thoughts on today's verdict. Also, the infrastructure plan that's being banged around by Biden and the gang of, I guess it's now 10 or 15 senators who are now playing in this field. I've got our good friend Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing to come talk with us. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you tonight and always.
So let's start with the today's verdict. Any surprise in today's verdict?
Well, look, I mean, justice was served. That's the most important thing. I echo Brian, who made that comment. You know, this is a stepping stone on the path to a more equitable society. And we have so many matters that we must make progress on, from the criminal justice system to policing to social equity and economic justice. I think what this administration is trying to do across a number of fronts, it's moving in the right direction on all of this. But a verdict like this reminds us that, you know, yes, justice was done, but this, unfortunately, has been an outlier so far, Rick. And we need to both obviously eliminate the number of cases of the police, murdering Black Americans and others, but also, you know, we need to move forward and build in more equity into our criminal justice system, our social network, and into our economic policies in the United States.
And part of it, I keep coming back to it. And as I said at the beginning, I've been fortunate. I've lived in very different environments. I grew up in a high poverty neighborhood. I now live in a solidly middle class neighborhood. So it's not that I've walked a mile in anyone's shoes, but I've taken a couple of steps. So I kind of have an idea of some of the problems. And for me, it keeps coming back to economics. It keeps coming down to, jobs and economy and wealth creation and folks having an opportunity to do better, especially, those people I grew up with who didn't have a sense that there was a future for them. They didn't have a sense that they were going to do better. I think we need to recreate an economy that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. I truly believe that.
I think you're absolutely right. And like you, I grew up in a rural part of Indiana that wasn't diverse at all, and it was fairly middle class, although it's declined over the last couple of decades. And one of the things that struck me doing this manufacturing policy work is just how two things. One is that the job loss has impacted workers of all races and ethnicities and has hit people hard. However, deindustrialization hit Black communities first. It hit it incredibly hard. And because of discriminatory policies, it meant that it had far worse outcomes for cities like Gary, Indiana, or Baltimore than it did for my little hometown of Rensselaer, Indiana. And so we have a lot of big issues to deal with, but they aren't confined to economic policy, but we do have to make serious progress on these in the years ahead.
What's interesting, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I had this weird conversation with the cashier at the gas station today. I don't know why, but it came up that, you know, there's cities like Detroit, you know, have been, you know, just decimated by the drug culture and things that went on. Because today's 420 day, for those who don't know, and that's how the conversation started. We wanted everybody to be happy. And he said, you know, places like Detroit were destroyed, but, you know, somewhere like Hiroshima, we bombed them and they came back. And I had to remind the kid that the Marshall Plan rebuilt that. We did that with policy, as where we've never done that in American inner cities. We've never had the kind of policies to rebuild the damage that's been done by deindustrialization.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the attempts that we have made at recoveries in the past, I mean, the New Deal was great on many levels. It was also discriminatory, which was a big challenge. And our housing policies, our environmental policies, all of this, you know, well into the 70s, the 80s, meant that the economic impacts were felt much harder in Black communities. And so my hope is that we can build on this and not backtrack, but understand that along with police reform and some of the other things that are necessary, that we have to make progress on building a social safety net, ending discriminatory policies, and making sure we have economic opportunity for Black communities as well.
And for everyone. I mean, at the end of the day, it still comes down to everyone does better when everyone does better. And in this moment where we're looking at massive investment in our infrastructure, we're looking at massive investment into manufacturing because our supply lines are very thin. We've got a lot of things that have to be done. While we're looking at this from a policy perspective, I keep coming back to that Marshall Plan idea that we invested a lot of money in the places we blew up to build it back better. This is why I love Biden's plan. Massive, chunky, huge investments that we need drastically have to be done now, which is why I'm fearful that with this gang of 15 that, no, we can do $600 billion over here or this over here, that we're not going to get the kind of jolt that I believe that we absolutely need.
Yeah, look, it's always worth talking to people to see if you can you can reach an agreement. But at the end of the day, I do think, and we've talked about this before, that we don't need to tinker around the edges here. We need a transformational investment to rebuild our infrastructure, which is subpar, as well as to lay the foundation for a new infrastructure, which includes broadband and schools and all the things that we take for granted, but that were built for a population at a time that was 40 or 50 or 60 years ago, and certainly not today or tomorrow. And then we also need to make investments to make a transformational change in the way that we produce and consume energy as well, through renewables here in America, I would add, and that we aren't simply trading a dependency on foreign oil that leads to bad climate consequences for a dependency on solar panels or batteries made in China, which leads to bad human rights, to bad actually pollution outcomes in China that spread around the world, as well as to bad jobs impacts in the United States. And I know, I will say this, I know the White House gets this, and both the plans that Biden laid out during the campaign, as well as the priorities that he has articulated, you know, in the first 90 days of this administration, they have been very clear. And, you know, we do need trillions. And so it's nice to have these conversations, $600-800 billion. If you can get something and you can do it in a bipartisan way and it's agreeable, do that. But we also need to do more. And if we need to do that with 50 votes and the vice president, that's what we have to do as well. But I don't think it's a deal and done on this. I think we have to have a massive investment that's going to far exceed anything that some of these Republicans who are willing to have a conversation would probably be willing to agree to.
And look, I look at the president came out today and said we're going to cut greenhouse emissions in half in what, 9 years?
Yeah.
2030 is just 9 years down the road, 8.5 years down the road. And we're going to do this really quickly. We need to create jobs. We need to create the infrastructure to do that, which is why I'm glad to see Cecil Roberts, the head of the UMWA, the United Mine Workers of America, coming out and saying, look, you know, we're gonna work with you because we need those jobs. They better be good union jobs.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's the important thing. No one is going to want to trade and granted, the jobs in mining have been steadily declining, both because of demand and but for other reasons as well. But you can't ask people to trade a job in the mines or a job on the oil rigs for a just above minimum wage job installing solar panels. That's not a just transition. That's not equitable. And that's something that will cause a big backlash in many parts of America. So you do have to make sure that we are making it in the United States as well,
right,
that we're making those wind turbines, that we're making those batteries, that we're making those solar panels, and that they're good jobs. And the way that you do that is through policy, through procurement policies, which are Buy American, through trade policies, which say we're going to keep tariffs on your project, on your products if you're subsidizing them, if you're dumping them, if you're polluting the environment to make them, and if you're exploiting your labor. And so, you know, I think with a lot of renewables, that's certainly the case when it comes to China. And then you have to build up the demand. You have to, and the climate goals are a part of that. And it's going to involve a lot of sectors of the economy. I mean, most people probably think about the power we consume, but you also have to think about transportation. You have to think about manufacturing. And, you know, the industry that I work most closely with, the steel industry, concrete, the investments that are going to need to transform those industries, as well as agriculture. So it's not like you can snap your fingers and make this happen. This is going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of careful policy to make sure that we are investing in the future and we're doing it in a way that's going to allow those good jobs to be created here in the United States rather than in China or other folks that may see a jobs benefit. So climate and jobs have to go hand in hand for this to be a successful policy.
No, I'm right there with you. And look, as you've said, we've got to secure our manufacturing. And as I say this all the time, you know, if the pandemic taught us anything, it's that our supply chains are way too thin and that we need to be thinking about domestic production for domestic consumption. And steel, concrete, those base elements, those base building blocks of the things that we need to rebuild our infrastructure should be front and foremost. Which is why, again, I was in support of the former guy putting tariffs on Chinese steel. Yeah. I was in favor of using, targeted tariffs. I don't think he did it well enough, but at least we went somewhat in the right direction.
Right. Yeah, I think it was necessary for our economic and national security because we only have one or two plants that make the armor plate, which is literally the foundation of our defense, you know, our kind of hard defense, right? And we only have, you know, one or two facilities in the United States that make the kind of steel that goes into our electrical grid. And so those to me seem like they're very essential industries to have here and to make sure that they are reliable.
Right, but here's the thing, Scott, and this is where a lot of people go, how did we get into this mess? Because I think a lot of people think, no, we can make all this stuff. We're America. We're the producer of the world. There's that bridge in Trenton, New Jersey. Trenton makes the world takes. We see it right there. How did we get into this mess?
Yeah. Well, look, part of it was about a philosophy. I mean, and the idea, and you're right, helping other countries to rebuild, that was absolutely the right thing to do. But then also using trade and using our workers as a pawn for some foreign policy goals was a huge mistake, And I guess you could somewhat get away with it with some European countries where there wasn't that much of a wage differential. But once you got into Mexico or China or some other of the Asian countries where there was a big wage differential at the time, it started costing us jobs. And at the same time, there was this idea of free markets and deregulation where, well, we don't want the government to get involved with this industry or that industry or what have you. Let's let the private sector take care of it. was motivated by greed, not by jobs in the United States. And so you had this convergence of these bad policies that eroded this. And then also, Rick, this idea that, well, we don't have to make things here. We're going to move into the knowledge economy, whatever that is, the services economy. We don't need those production jobs. We can design things here and we'll make them overseas. Well, we've discovered, as you said, through the PPE, through the semiconductors, through a lot of instances now where you can't do that. You cannot do that successfully, that you have to design things here and you have to make them here. It doesn't mean we shut ourselves off from the rest of the world, but we do have to have balance. We have to have that capability. We don't make a single smartphone in this country right now, which seems absolutely crazy considering the amount of technological prowess that we have. But I'll bet if you had a strategy that says we want to make smartphones here, we'll find a way to do it because we have, you know, ingenious entrepreneurs. We have a good workforce. We obviously have a massive consumer market. But what we've lacked was that kind of like, you know, that guidance. It's like, well, can we find a way to make it here? Silicon Valley, all the MBA programs, they say, you know, the first thing, well, that's a great idea. Which city are you going to make it in China? That's the next question that they ask. Not how can you get that done in the United States? We have to simply change that formulation. We change it through policy, and we change it through obviously expressing a preference for buying American as well. And we can get there. Yeah. Because I know that we can do great things as a country.
Last question I've got for you, because China's not going to give this up easily. No. I mean, granted, we gave it to them. But, you know, this is an authoritarian country. This is a communist country. They are capitalists, they claim, a very twisted version of it. But they're not giving this up easily. We're not going to be able to win this stuff back. We have to fight for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't mean literally fight, but we do have to stand up for our own economic rights, and that includes using all the tools in the toolbox, including tariffs. And let's be very honest here. It's not that, you know, a bunch of cheap T-shirts is not enough to sustain a relationship like that. We can find a substitute for that.
Yep.
But we got to make the semiconductors here. We got to make our renewable energy future here. And we may need tariffs to do that. And we're not alone in this. I mean, Mexico, Canada, they face this China challenge as well. A lot of European countries do. We can't expect China to change its behavior.
Nope.
But we have to make sure that it doesn't hurt us.
Yeah, we've got great opportunities. We just have to have the will, the political will, and the vision to do it. Scott, I appreciate you taking some time. Always great talking with you, my friend.
Of course, Rick. Thanks. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1914, the bloody anniversary of the Ludlow Massacre. 11,000 miners had gone on strike against the Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation, owned by one of the wealthiest men in the world, John D. Rockefeller. The strikers wanted recognition of the United Mine Workers of America as their union, increased wages, improved safety, and an 8-hour workday. The miners lived in company towns, where they had to shop in the company stores despite their high prices and had to visit company doctor. The strikers wanted an end to this repressive practice. During the strike, the workers and their families were evicted from the company houses. The evicted miners moved into tent camps on land leased by the UMWA. The bitter strike raged on, and on this, the morning after miners celebrated Orthodox Easter, National Guardsmen, paid by the company, approached the camp at Ludlow. Some drove up in an armored car mounted with a machine gun. Its nickname was the Death Special. At 10 a.m., they began shooting indiscriminately into the tents. That night, some guardsmen snuck down to the tents armed with kerosene. They lit the tents on fire. Two women and 11 children were hiding in a dugout hole beneath one tent to avoid the flying bullets. They were burnt to death. In all, between 19 and 25 men, women, and children were murdered. Despite national outrage, neither Rockefeller nor any of the shooters were ever held accountable. 2 years later, the UMWA purchased the Ludlow site for commemoration. In 2008, it became a National Historic Landmark. Singer-songwriter Woody Guthrie wrote this tribute to the martyred miners and their families.
So afraid you'd kill our children, dug us a cave that's 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and a pregnant woman down inside.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.